The king's house where I live is a square divided in four quarters. The great laurel tree is at the crossing, the center. I go out at first dawn from the house and from the city into the fields east of the city. The pagus where we pagans live is the pattern of the farmer's fields, outlined by the paths between the fields. At the crossing, where four fields meet, is the shrine of the Lares, the spirits of the meeting place. The shrine has four doors, and before each door is the altar of a farmer's field. I stand out on one of the paths between fields, looking at the sky. The house of the sky is limitless, but with my mind I give it borders and divide it into four. I stand at the center, the crossing, facing south, facing Ardea. I watch the empty sky into which light flows upward slowly. Crows fly from the left, from the eastern hills, circle above me calling, and return into the sunrise that crowns the hills with fire. It is a good omen, but the red sunrise foretells a stormy day. I was 12 when I first went with my father to Albunea, the sacred forest under the hill, where sulfur springs running out from a high cave fill the shadowy air with an endless, troubled noise and a mist that smells of rotten eggs. There the spirits of the dead are within hearing if you call. In the old days people came to Albunea from all the western lands to consult with the spirits and powers of the place. Now many go to the oracle near Tabor, which bears the same name. This lesser Albunea was sacred to my family. When my father was disturbed in his mind, he went there. This time he said to me, "Wear your sacred robe, daughter, and come help me with the sacrifice." I had served as his assistant often at home, as a child's duty is, but I had never yet been to the sacred spring. I put on my red-bordered toga and took a bag of salted meal from the storeroom behind Vesta. We walked for some miles on paths through familiar fields and pastures. Then we were in country I hadn't seen before, wilder, the forested hills drawing closer on both sides. We came to a little stream and followed the north side of its rocky gorge. It was called the Prati, my father said, and he told me of the rivers of Latium, our Lentulus at Laurentum, the Herinosus, the Prati, the Stagnalus, and the sacred Numicus that rises high on the Alban Mountain and is our boundary with Rutulia. He carried the sacrifice, a 2-week lamb. It was April. The thickets were all budding and in bloom, and the oaks on the hillsides bore their long, delicate, reticent flowers of green and bronze. The forests ahead of us rose up and up towards the Alban Mountain, and craggy woods hung like a dark cloud to our left. We entered under the trees. It was dark in the forest, and only a few birds sang, though the fields and thickets had been loud with their chanting. I smelled the stink of the spring nearby, but didn't see the vapors, and heard the noise of the water only faintly, a hissing murmur like a kettle coming to the boil. The sacred place was in a grassy glade deep in the forest, marked out in a rough square with a rock wall no higher than my knee. Within that enclosure, the sense of the Numen, the presence and power of the sacred, was strong and strange. Tattered, rotting fleeces lay about on the earth inside the wall. There was a small rock altar. My father cut a turf from outside the wall and laid it on the altar. We drew the corner of our togas over our heads. He lighted the fire. I made a garland of young laurel leaves and garlanded the lamb. I sprinkled it with salted meal from my bag and held it while he prayed. The lamb was docile and fearless, a noble sacrifice. It had its own piety. I held it while my father cut its throat with a long bronze knife, offering this life to the powers we don't know, in fear and gratitude, and seeking to be in peace with them. We burned the entrails on the altar fire to augment the power of the spirits. We toasted and ate the ribs ourselves, having not eaten since noon the day before. The rest of the meat I wrapped to carry home. My father scraped the hide and laid it down on the ground, the fleece up, and gathered the remnants of other sheepskins and spread them out. They were damp from the rain a couple of days earlier, and stank of rot and mildew. But that is one's bed at Albunea. It was quite dark now. The red of the sun was gone from the aisles of the trees, and the sky between the branches was dim. We lay down on the sheepskins, the fleece of our lamb under our heads. I don't know if the power of Albunea came into my father that night, but it came to me. Not as a voice speaking from the trees as it comes to others, but as a dream, or what I took to be a dream. In my sleep I was beside a river, which I knew to be the Numicus. I stood at a ford, alone, watching the clear water run among the stones. I saw a thread of color in the water as it ran by, a vein of red. It thickened and blurred into a cloud of red that drifted downstream and was gone. A heavy, heavy weight of grief bore down my heart, so that my knees failed and I crouched, weeping among the stones. At last I got up and walked upstream and came to a town. Its ramparts were of fresh earth. I was still weeping and held the corner of my garment over my head and face, but I knew that city was my home. Then in my dream I was in the forest of Albunea again, still alone. This time I went past the altar glade and came to the spring. I couldn't come close to the cave. The hissing, boiling noise was loud there, and all about the mouth of the cave the ground was bog and shallow pools. The stinking, bluish mist hovered over the water and the ground. I heard a woodpecker off among the trees, his tapping on a trunk and his call like a harsh laugh. Then he came flying. I drew back, pulling the cloth over my head, afraid. But he didn't strike me. I saw his scarlet head flash before me. He drew his wings across my eyes twice, very lightly, like the touch of the softest veil. He laughed as he flew off. I looked up and saw it wasn't dark under the trees. The forest was full of a still light without shadows, and the water and mist of the spring were luminous. I woke then, and saw that same still light for a while in the glade, fading as day came. Before we left, I went on to the spring, and saw it was as I had seen it in my dream, though shadowed. My father was again silent as we started home. As we came out of the forest, I looked south, imagining the course of the Numicus, the ford, and the place where I had seen the town in my dream. I said, "Grandfather Picus came to me while I slept last night, Father." And I told him what I had seen. He listened and said nothing for a time. "That is a powerful grandfather," he said at last. "He struck my head when I had the fever. I cried for the pain."
"But this time he touched your eyes with his wing."
I nodded. We walked on a while. Latina said,
"Albunea is in his gift, he and the other powers of the woods. He has given you the freedom of it, daughter. He has opened your eyes to see."
"May I come with you again?"
"You may come there when you choose, I think."
If my daughter had lived, she never could have run safe and free through fields outside our domains, or along the hillsides among the grazing herds, as I used to run. When my son was a boy, The forests were safer for him than the Pegasus fields. But when I was a girl, I walked the open hillsides and the wilderness paths to Albunea with no companion but Maruna. Sometimes she accompanied me all the way. Sometimes she stayed the night with a woodcutter's family at the edge of the forest, while I went alone to the sacred glade. We could do this because the peace my father had brought to Latium was real and durable. In that peace, little children could watch the cattle. Shepherds could let their flocks wander in the summer pastures with no risk of theft. Women and girls need not go guarded or in bands, but could walk without fear on any path in Latium. Even in the true wild, where there were no paths, we were afraid of wolf and boar, not man. Because this order had held all my life as a girl, I thought it was the way the world had always been and would be. I hadn't learned how peace galls men, how they gather impatient rage against it as it continues, how even while they pray the powers for peace, they work against it and make certain it will be broken and give way to battle, slaughter, rape, and waste. Of all the greater powers, the one I fear most is the one I can't worship, the one who walks the boundary, the one who sets the ram on the ewe, and the bull on the heifer, and the sword in the farmer's hand. Mavors, Marmor, Mars. I kept the storerooms of the king's house. That was my duty as the king's daughter, the Camilla, the novice. The food we ate was in my charge. I ground the meal and the sacred salt that blessed the food. Daily and faithfully I cared for Vesta, burning on our hearth, the bright center of our lives. But I wasn't permitted to enter the small room beside the house door where Mars lived. Not Mars of the plow, Mars of the bull and stallion, nor Mars of the wolf, but the other one. Mars the sword, the spears, the shields that the leapers brought out on the day of the new year, shaking him, waking him, rousing him up, dancing and leaping with him in the streets and through the fields. That Mars would be shut away again only when the October horse had been sacrificed and winter itself, with cold and rain and darkness, ordained the peace. Mars has no altar in the city. Men worship him. A girl, a virgin, I could have no business with him and wanted none. The house I kept was close to him, as his was to me. But I honored the sanction. He did not. When I was a girl, I didn't know him well enough to fear him. I liked to see the leapers rush to open that locked room on the first day of March and come out in red cloaks and high pointed hats, dancing, driving out the old year, letting in the new, brandishing the long spears and the shields, shaped like an owl's face, cavorting and shouting through the streets of Laurentum. Mavors, mavors, macte esto. We girls ran from them and hid as we were supposed to do, in a dutiful, laughing mockery of fear. Oh, how the men like to stick their spears up in the air, we said. Oh, how they like to poke their spears and jab their spears. Oh, don't they wish their spears were always 10 feet long? Because we were at peace, I could laugh at the leapers. Because we were at peace, I could sleep alone in Albunea. Because we were at peace, my father saw no harm in it when more suitors for my hand began coming to the Regia. Let them vie with one another. Let Aventinus scowl at Turnus. Let Turnus snub young Almo. They dared not quarrel under the king's roof or break the king's peace across their boundaries. One of them would prove the best man in the end and take me to his house, and the others must make the best of it. My father enjoyed their visits very much, far more than I did. They brought young manhood into the house. He liked to feast them well and give them wine, pouring their bowls full again and again. He liked their gifts of game and sausage and white kids and black piglets. He liked them to see his beautiful, fiery queen, so much younger than he, not so much older than some of them. He was a good and generous host, and his geniality disarmed their touchy brashness and their rivalries. They ended up all laughing late into the night at the great table. He made what might have been a cause of quarrels into a way to better friendship among his subject kings and chieftains. If he had been my only parent, I might have taken my suitors lightly, as he did, and with pleasure. Some of them were good fellows. Some were easy to laugh at. Ufens of Nersai, a mountain man, came in wolfskins, with a wolfskin hat, a black curly beard all over his red face, staring around him as if he'd never been in a town before, glowering at everybody except me. He couldn't look at me at all. Tita and the other women teased me endlessly about marrying him, the wolf boy, Chin Thicket, they called him. And I could laugh with them. But I was polite and cautious and cold to all my suitors, even beyond what befitted my status as virgin prize. For my mother didn't take the matter lightly at all, and made my position both difficult and false. She wanted to marry me to her nephew Turnus of Ardea. That desire had come to possess her. She favored Turnus openly, was all smiles to him, and hardly civil to the others who came to stand in his way. Her prejudice made it hard even for rich men like Aventinus to come courting me, and very hard for such a young man as Almo, son of Tyrus, the manager of the royal cattle herds, my Sylvia's eldest brother. Almo was aiming pretty high in courting me at all, and against such a rival as King Turnus, he stood no chance. But he wasn't merely ambitious. He had fallen in love with me, and having been fond of him all my life as an almost brother, I was sorry for him and kind to him, and so gave him false hope. My mother had no pity on him. She was fiercely jealous of our royal honor. She treated Almo as a cowherd. My father shouldn't have allowed such discourtesy in his hall, but still he let all she did and said go by, and she hid the worst of her behavior from him. It was the game they played, that she could be mad, yet not mad, because he wouldn't know she was mad. I didn't want to be courted. I didn't want to receive the game, the sausages, the kids, the piglets, the stiff compliments. I didn't want to sit at the banquet, the silent, modest maiden, while my mother Amata spurned and sneered and turned her back on honest men and wooed her sister's son, handsome, blue-eyed Turnus. He didn't snub or spurn her. Never. Of course not. He smiled. He murmured. He lowered his long eyelashes and lifted them again, smiling, and looked right through her to what he wanted. Could she not see that? Could I, a stupid virgin of 17, see it, and she not see it? Could my father sit at the head of the table and not see it? Drances, an old friend and adviser of my father, was the only person of the household who showed dislike or distrust of Turnus. Drances greatly admired the sound of his own voice, and was used to pontificating at our table. But now he had to listen to Turnus's tales of his exploits and triumphs in skirmishes and raids and hunts, and endure the young man's careless, genial, unintended discourtesies. I saw that Drances watched Turnus very keenly, and watched my mother, too. Sometimes he would glance at my father, or even at me, as if to say, "Do you see?" My father was impervious, and I wouldn't return his glance. I wanted nothing to do with Drances. It seemed he knew what I knew, but I didn't know what he would do with the knowledge. I came to the banquets because I must, and I left as soon as I could. The only way I could avoid my suitors entirely was not to be in the house at all. These days I could go to Sylvia's farm only if I knew poor ardent Almo wouldn't be there. I could achieve absence from the Regia only by going to Albunea. My mother's anger was chafed by the idea that I had some gift like my father's of conversation with the spirits. It gave me a kind of uncanny importance, which she despised. I agreed with her in my heart. The importance was false. But the gift was real, and it was useful to me as my reason not to be always at home. Dressed in white, the meek garlanded sacrifice, while the suitors paraded through and drank their wine, and Turnus flattered my mother and laughed with my father and looked at me as the butcher looks at the cow. Amata tried to forbid me to go to the sacred place, for many good reasons, which she argued eloquently. My father, as always, seemed hardly to hear her. Usually that was how she got her way, but where I was concerned, his deafness was different. He temporized, waved his hand mildly, said, "Oh, it will do the child no harm," or, "Prince Aventinus will still be here, no doubt, when she returns," and let me go. And I put on my red-bordered robe, told Maruna to be ready at dawn, and went. Turnus came for a visit in late April of the year I was 18. He brought a wagon-load of splendid gifts to my parents. One was a horrible little creature that he said sailors had brought from Africa. It had hands and feet like ours, and a face like a noseless baby. He brought it in riding his shoulder, dressed in a tiny toga. It clambered all about, chattering, pulling things to pieces, spilling the salt, then stopping to sit and fondle its penis and stare at us with bright black eyes. Everyone at the long table laughed at its tricks. He presented it as a pet for me, and I tried to be kind to the little animal, but I couldn't like it, and it hated me. It pulled my hair and pissed my dress, and then sprang into my mother's arms. She kissed it and crooned over it. It pulled at the chains round her neck, tugged out the little gold bulas that held my brother's amulets, and put one in its mouth. Seeing that, the sickness came over me. I had to ask to be excused, and as always my father let me go, though my mother would have made me stay. I ran out into the courtyard and stopped at the fountain under the great laurel to wash my face and hands and my pala, where the animal had pissed it. The night was cool, the stars bright through the leaves of the laurel. How I loved this house! How could I ever leave it? Leave the spirits of the tree, of the spring, of my storerooms, of the hearth, of my people. Leave the beloved familiar powers, and go serve those of a stranger in a strange place. That would be slavery. I wouldn't do it. Maybe I would marry Almo, and my father would name him his heir, to be king after him, and we would live here, here, nowhere else. I knew that couldn't be. Yet my father had no heir, and some day he must name one, or adopt a son. I thought I didn't care who it was, so long as it wasn't Turnus. There was nothing much wrong with Turnus himself, but much wrong in the way my mother looked at him. I went on to the women's side of the house. I told Maruna we were going to the forest tomorrow morning. Old Vestina said, "The Rutulian prince has just arrived, child. That is scarcely courteous." And Maruna's mother, the Etruscan slave who had taught me to read the bird's flight, a wise and gentle woman, said, "It might be better to put it off a day or two." "My mother can entertain King Turnus far better than I can," I said, staring them both down, daring them to speak. Vestina chirped, "But it's you, you he comes to see, how he looks at you. Anyone can see you have his heart." Maruna's mother said nothing, and I left with Maruna at daybreak. I took my bag of salted meal. The pastures were full of spring lambs, bouncing about, whirling their tails as they sucked at the teat. But I needed no blood sacrifice when I went to Albunea. I scattered salsamola on the altar, slept on the old fleeces of other sacrifices, and sought no vision or guidance. All I wanted when I went there was to sleep there, in that silence, with those spirits around me, in the Newman of Albunea. A night there clarified my heart and quieted my mind, so that I could come back home and do my duty. The walk there was an escape, too, a time of freedom. Maruna wasn't light-hearted and adventurous like my Sylvia, and we didn't chatter all day long when we walked, as Sylvia and I did. Maruna was rather silent, but alert, noticing all things in earth and sky. She was patient, sweet, a good companion. She didn't have Sylvia's way with animals, but she knew the birds, and she had learned some of her mother's lore, so we talked about what we might read in the calls and flights of the birds in the fields and wild lands about us as we went. And sometimes we talked about what the dead might have to say to us. In Etruria, they think much about the dead, and Maruna's mother had been trained in that knowledge when she was a girl in the great city of Kyre. I felt ignorant and rustic when she or her daughter spoke of it. To me, the dead were best buried, left undisturbed, thought about as little as possible. One didn't want to bring their unhappy shadows creeping across the floor, hiding under the table, snapping at dropped food, for they were hungry, the dead were, always hungry. Every spring my father, like every householder in Latium, walked all about his house at midnight with 9 black beans in his mouth, and when he spat them out he said, "Shadows be gone." And the ghosts that had infested the house ate the beans and went back underground. But according to Maruna's mother, the matter of the dead wasn't that simple. Maybe it was she who had opened my mind, so that when I slept at Albunea that night in April when I was 18, on that ground that is so thin, a roof above the underworld, the poet could come to me, and I could see and speak to him. Maruna turned off on the path to the woodcutter's hut, and I went on into the forest alone. When I walked there, I always remembered the dream I had the first time I went to Albunea, the blood in the river, the city on a hill, the quiet radiance that filled the darkness under the trees. No one was in the sacred place. But there had been recent sacrifices. Fresh fleeces lay on the ground, and a stack of unburned wood by the altar. I scattered salted meal on the altar and all about the enclosure, and wished I could light a little fire, but I had brought none. So I went to the springs while the sun was still up, and sitting on a rocky outcrop above the cave mouth, I watched the light grow reddish across the misty pools, and listened to the troubled voice of the water. After a while I moved farther up the hill, where I could hear birds singing near and far in the silence of the trees. The presence of the trees was very strong. For the first time I wondered if I might hear the voice that my father heard speak from among them in the dark. The big oaks stood so many, so massive in their other life, in their deep, rooted silence. The awe of them came on me. The religion. I went back to the sacred enclosure praying, very humbly beseeching these great powers to have pity on my weakness. I was glad I had lit no fire. I made a heap of the fleeces, rolled up in my red-edged toga, for the air was cool, and lay down in the late dusk to sleep. I became aware that a figure was standing within the enclosure, on the other side of the altar, a tall shadow. For a moment I thought it was a tree, then I saw it was a man. I sat up and said, "Be welcome here." I wasn't afraid, but the awe was still in me. The religion bound me. He spoke.
What is this place?
His voice was very low. The altar place of Albunea.
Albunea,
he said. I could see that he was looking around, though it was quite dark, a thin high mist dimming the starlight. After a minute he said again, wondering, almost with a laugh in his voice,
So it is. And you are?
Lavinia, daughter of Latinus. He repeated the name.
Lavinia.
Then he did laugh, a brief ha of amazement and amusement. He said at last,
May I stay a while, Lavinia, daughter of King Latinus.
The altar place is open to all men. And I added, There are fleeces here to sit on, or sleep on. I have more than I need.
I need nothing, king's daughter,
he said. He came a few steps closer, so that the altar wasn't between us, and sat down on the ground.
I am a wraith,
he said.
I am not here in my body. My body is lying on the deck of a ship sailing from Greece to Italy. But I don't think I'll get to Brundisium, even if the ship does. I am sick. I am dying. I am on my way to Acheron. Or else I am a false dream. But they come from under there, don't they? The false dreams. They nest like bats in the great tree at the gates of the kingdom of the shadows. So maybe I am a bat that has flown here from Hades, a dream that has flown into a dream, into my poem. To Albunea, the sacred grove, where King Latinus heard his grandfather Faunus' prophecy, telling him not to marry his daughter to a man of Latium. His voice was low and musical, like the voice of one talking to the spirits, praying, and that almost laugh came and went in it. But I said quite sharply, Did he? I couldn't help it. Surely my father would have told me if he had received such a warning. Why would he keep it from me? The man, the shadow, paused. He thought, and he said, Perhaps not yet.
He knew that he had surprised, disturbed me, and wanted to reassure me. I felt then for the first time his kindness, his searching kindness, sensitive to every suffering. He went on, hesitant.
I think it hasn't happened yet. Faunus hasn't spoken to Latinus. Perhaps it never did, never will happen. You shouldn't be concerned about it. I made it up. I imagined it. A dream within a dream, within the dream that has been my life.
I am not a dream. I don't think I'm dreaming, I said after a while. I spoke mildly, for he was sad, very sad. He had said he was dying. He was adrift, bereft, poor soul. I wanted to give him comfort, better comfort than can be found in dreams. He looked at me as if he could see me, as if light filled the glade, light not of sun or moon or star or fire. He studied me. I didn't mind it. There was no insolence in him. I couldn't possibly fear him.
I believe you, he said. How old are you, Lavinia?
18, last January.
Ripe now for a man. A full age now for marriage,
he said gently, and I knew it was a line of a song, though I didn't know the song. Oh, yes, I said, very dryly. I felt no shyness, no falseness with him. My response surprised the brief laugh from him again.
"Perhaps I didn't do you justice, Lavinia," he said.
It seemed he too could say anything to me, whether I understood it or not. That was all right. "What should I call you?" He said his name, and I said, "You're Etruscan?"
"I'm a Mantuan. I had Etruscan grandfathers."
"How did you know?"
"Maru Maro. It's an Etruscan name."
"So it is.
Ah, but how long ago? How long ago you lived, Lavinia?"
"Centuries, centuries." "Is there any Mantua now? Yet? Do you know that name?"
"No." He said after a pause, and with a kind of wondering, passionate urgency,
"Rome. Do you know that name?"
"No, but the Etruscans call..." I stopped. The secret name of the river isn't to be spoken to all. Did he know it? But why keep secrets from a wraith, from a dying man? "One of Tiber's sacred names is Rumon."
"She came to Albunea by herself," he said, speaking into the darkness, "and knew the sacred names of the river, and had no wish to be married. And I knew nothing of all that. I never looked at her. I had to tell what the men were doing. Perhaps I can..."
But he broke off, and presently said,
"No, no chance of that."
He looked around again, and sighed, and said,
"I keep thinking I'll wake up and see the damned deck of the ship, and the gulls overhead, and the sun that goes across the sky so slowly, and the damned Greek doctor."
I have said we understood each other, that we spoke the same language. I did understand him, though he used words I didn't know. We sat in silence for a while. An owl called to the left. An owl answered from the right.
"Tell me," he said. "Have they come yet? The Trojans?"
A word I didn't know. "Tell me who they are."
"You'll know who they are when they come, Latinus's daughter."
"I am..." He hesitated.
"I am searching for my duty here. How much is it right for me to tell you? Do you want to know your future, Lavinia?"
"No," I said at once. Then I sought in my own mind for my duty, or my will, and finally said, "I want to know what's right to do, but I don't want to know what's to come of it."
"It's enough to know what ought to come of it," he said, gravely agreeing.
I felt his smile, though I couldn't see it. The left-hand owl called again. The right-hand owl replied.
"Oh," he said, "the air is so cool, the night is so dark, and the owls call, and the earth, the dirt. This is Italy. I'm home. I wish I could die here. Here, not on that wooden deck on the sea in the sun. Here, on this dirt. But this isn't my body. This is only my delirium."
"I think you are here," I said. "Only your body is not. But I see you. I talk with you. Tell me who the Trojans are."
"No, no, no. I must not. They are yet to come. Do what's right to do, and what follows will be what should follow."
He laughed.
"Tell me, have you any suitors, Lavinia? Ripe now for a man, of full age for marriage?"
"Yes."
"What are their names?"
"Clausus the Sabine, Almo Tyrus's son, Ufens of Nersai, Aventinus, Turnus of Rutulia.
And you favor none of them?
I favor none of them.
Why is that?
Why should I? Where can a man take me that is better than my father's house? What do I want with a lesser king? Why should I serve Lares that aren't my family's Lares, the Penates of some other woman's storerooms, the fire of a foreign hearth? Why? Why is a girl brought up at home to be a woman in exile the rest of her life?
Ha!
He said. Not a laugh this time, but a long outbreath.
I don't know, Lavinia. I don't know. But listen. If a man came, to marry you who was a man among a thousand, a warrior, a hero, a handsome man.
Turnus is all that.
Has he piety?
The word brought me up short, but I had no doubt of my answer. No, I said.
Well, if a man came who was heroic and also responsible and just and faithful, a man who had lost much and suffered much and made a good many mistakes and paid for them all, a man who saw his city betrayed and burned and saved his father and his son from the burning, a man who went down alive into the underworld and returned, a man who learned piety the hard way, might you favor such a man?
I would certainly pay attention to him, I said.
It would be wise to do so.
A silence fell between us, companionable. I said at last, have you seen, when the young men have archery contests, sometimes they catch a dove and put a cord round her foot, and shinny up a high pole and tie her to the top, leaving just enough cord so she thinks she can fly. And then she is the target of their arrows.
I have seen that.
If I were an archer, I'd break the cord with my arrow.
That, too, I have seen. But another man shot the dove as she flew free.
After a while, I said, perhaps it's just as well that women don't learn to shoot arrows.
Camilla did. You know of her?
A woman archer?
A woman warrior. Beautiful. Invincible. From Volscia.
I shook my head. All I knew of the Volscians was what my father said. Savage fighters. Faithless allies.
Well,
the wraith said,
I suppose I did invent her.
But I liked her. Invent her?
I am a poet, Lavinia.
I liked the sound of the word, but he saw I didn't know it.
Avates,
he said. I knew that word, of course. Foreteller. Soothsayer. It went with his being part Etruscan, and with the knowledge he seemed to have of what hadn't happened yet. But I didn't see what it had to do with this woman warrior, who sounded like a mere story to me. Would you tell me more about the man who is coming? He pondered a little, even though we were talking with such ease and openness, in perfect trust, as if we were both shadows, harmless and invulnerable, with all eternity before us. Still, he was a man who thought before he spoke.
Yes, he said. I can do that. What do you want to know?
Why is he coming here?
That, I think, I shouldn't tell you now. Time will tell. But I think it wouldn't be wrong for me to tell you where he is coming from.
I am listening. I got more comfortable on the fleeces.
Oh, Lavinia,
he said,
you are worth 10 Camillas, and I never saw it.
Well, never mind.
Did you ever hear of Troy?
Yes. It's a little town south of here, near Ardea.
Ah, not that Troia. This one was a great city, far east of here, east of the Middle Sea, east of the Isles of Greece, on the shore of Asia. There was a pretty prince of Troy named Paris. He and a Greek queen ran off together. Her husband called the other kings of Greece together, and they went to Troy. A great army in 1,000-beaked ships to get the woman back. Helen, her name was.
What did they want her back for?
Her husband's honor demanded it.
I should think his honor demanded that he divorce her and find himself a decent wife.
Lavinia, these people were Greeks, not Italians.
King Evander's a Greek. I wonder if he'd chase after a cheating wife.
Lavinia, daughter of the king, will you let me tell my tale?
I'm sorry. I won't talk.
Then I will tell you the story of the fall of Troy, as Aeneas told it to the queen of Carthage.
He said. And he sat up straighter, there on the dark ground, a shadow among shadows, and began to sing. It wasn't singing like the shepherd's songs or rowers' choruses, or the hymns at Ambarvalia and Compitalia, or the songs women sing all day at spinning and weaving and pounding and chopping and cleaning and sweeping. There was no tune to it. Its words were all the music of it. Its words were its drumbeat, clack of the loom, tread of feet, oar stroke, heartbeat, waves breaking on the beach at Troy, away across the world. I can't say here all he sang, about the great horse, and the snakes that came out of the sea, and the fall of the city. I will tell only what I have most thought about in the tale. When the Greeks came out of the horse and let their army into the city, Aeneas, the Trojan warrior, fought against them in the streets. He fought in a kind of madness, furious, mindless, until he saw the king's high house afire. Then his mind cleared. He thought of his own house and people, and ran there. That house was some way from the center of the city, and it was still quiet there. As he went through the streets, he saw great powers made visible, moving in the darkness, the powers that willed Troy to burn. When he got home, he tried to get his people to leave the house, escape the city, save themselves. But his father Anchises wouldn't go. Anchises was crippled, could hardly walk. He said he would die in his own house. But the house people wouldn't leave him there, wouldn't go without him. Aeneas was about to give up, rush back into the madness and get himself killed in the street fighting. His wife, Creusa, stopped him and told him he had no right to do that. It was his duty and hers to try to save their people. She had their little son, Ascanius, with her, and as she spoke, someone said, "Look!" And they saw that the boy's hair had caught fire. A gold flame leapt up over his head. They put it out, but old Anchises, who could read omens, said it was a good omen. Then they saw a shooting star run across the sky and fall into the forest up on the mountain over the city, Mount Ida. Anchises said they should follow that star. So Aeneas told all the house people to scatter out and run, get out of the city any way they could, and told them where to meet. At a mound with an old altar of the Grain Mother, outside the city gate, under Mount Ida. Then Anchises carried the household gods in a big clay pot, and Aeneas carried cripple Anchises on his back. He took little Ascanius's hand, and Creusa followed him. And so they set off through the dark streets. But Anchises saw soldiers down a side street and shouted to Aeneas to run. Aeneas obeyed, turned aside, running blindly in the dark, and lost his way. Finally, he recognized a street and made his way, still carrying his father and holding the little boy's hand, to the gate, and came out to the altar where all his people were waiting for him. Only then he realized his wife wasn't with them. She'd been behind him when he turned and ran, and he never looked back to see if she was with him. No one had seen her. So he went back into the city alone. He ran to their house, thinking she might have gone there. The whole house was burning, full of flame. He ran through the city shouting, "Creusa! Creusa!" Past the ruined buildings, and the fires, and the soldiers killing and looting. And then he saw her. She stood in front of him in the dark street. But she was taller than herself, and she said, "I will not go with you, nor will I be the slave of any Greek. The Earth Mother keeps me here, and you must go a long way for a long time. You must go, my sweet husband, until at last you come to the Western Land. There you will be a king and have a queen. No tears for me, but let your love guard our son." And he tried to speak to her and to take her in his arms. 3 times he tried. But it was like putting his arms around the wind, around a dream. She was gone into the shadow. So he went back to the altar mound, where a great crowd of people had gathered now, fleeing the city, joining his house people. No Greeks had followed them out of the city yet. He took his father up on his back again, and led them all up into the hills, where the shooting star had fallen. It was almost morning. I remember that as the poet's voice died away, the first bird piped up, thin and far off, though there was no light yet in the sky, and no voice answered. Here, too, it was almost morning. I looked where the shadow of the poet had been, and there was nothing. I lay down in the fleeces and slept till the sun's light, piercing and flashing through the dark trunks and thickets of the forest, woke me. I was ravenously hungry, a wolf. I went straight to the woodcutter's cottage, where Maruna was waiting for me. It was the old kind of house, one tall round room of stakes with a roof of boughs, all thatched with straw. The woodcutter was already gone to his work in the woods. I asked his wife for food. She had nothing but a scrape of spelt porridge and a cup of sour goat's milk, which she was frightened to offer me because she thought such poor stuff would insult me and I'd be angry with her. I gobbled it up. Having nothing to give her, I kissed her. I thanked her for feeding the she-wolf. She laughed in bewilderment. "I ate everything you have. What will you eat?" I asked, and she said comfortably, "Oh, he always brings a rabbit or some birds." "Perhaps I'll wait," I said. But my joke bewildered her again. No doubt she thought we always ate meat at the king's house. So I set off with Maruna. There was a great joy in me that morning. Maruna saw it and asked, "Was it a good night there?" "Yes, I saw my kingdom," I said. I didn't know myself what I meant. "And I saw a great city fall, all burning, and a man came out of it with a man on his back, and he is coming here." She listened, believed me, asked nothing. I could say that. I could talk that way to Maruna, my slave and sister, but not to anyone else. All the way home I puzzled how I could win my way back to Albunea, soon, as soon as possible, and stay there more than one night. For I was quite certain that the poet would come back, but equally certain that he couldn't come back for long. His time with me was limited. He was on his way down to the Shadowland, and it wouldn't be a long journey for him. I turned aside from our path and walked to the little river Prati, running shallow and bright on its stones. I was thirsty, and knelt to drink above the ford there, marked with the hooves of cattle. When I looked up from drinking, the ford made me think of the place I had stood in my dream 6 years before, and seen the blood in the water, on the river Numicus. A dread and awe came into me. I stood, and opened my meal bag, and scattered salsamola on the stones. I looked up at Maruna, standing patiently on the river bank, a tall girl my age, with a long, dark, soft Etruscan face. Tying up the meal bag, I said, "Maruna, I need to go back to Albunea soon, and maybe stay more than one night." She pondered for half a mile homeward before she said, "Not while King Turnus is here." "No. But when he leaves, will the king ask why you want to go?" "Probably. And you can't lie about sacred things." "You can be silent, though," said Maruna. "I am the king's daughter," I said, thinking how the poet had called me that. "I will do as I will do, and the king will nod his head." I laughed out loud, and then I said, "Look, look, Maruna, there's Sylvia's deer. What's he doing so far from home?" The big stag was walking on an open hillside, just above a field, where the new crops were coming up green. His white linen neckpiece was torn and dingy, but his antlers were splendid in their new velvet. Maruna pointed a little way ahead of the stag. A slender doe was drifting along, nibbling a grass stem here and there, ignoring her follower entirely. "That's what he's doing so far from home. Mating season or not, just like Turnus," I said, and laughed again. Nothing could keep my heart down that morning. So with that courage in me, I went to my father as soon as I got home and greeted him and said, "Father, when our guest has gone, may I go to Albunea again? Maruna will go with me, and anyone else if you wish, if you think I need to be guarded. I wish to sleep there alone, more than one night." Latinus looked at me, a long look, affectionate, distant, judging. He was about to ask me a question, and then he didn't. "I begrudge every night you are not under my roof, daughter. How much longer will I have you? But I trust you. Go to the sacred place when you will. Stay as you must. Return when you can." "I will," I said, and thanked him, and he kissed my forehead. Then, because fathers must be stern, he said, "I expect you to be at the banquet tonight, and no sulking, no green swoons." "Then keep the African creature from me." "I will," he said, and I saw perfectly well that he was thinking he wished he could keep the man who brought the African creature from me, too, but he said nothing. So I endured the rest of Turnus's visit, meek and maidenly, even saying a word or two at the table now and then. Turnus, in fact, paid very little attention to me. He didn't need to. It was my father he must persuade. My mother, of course, was already wooed and won. The tricky bit for Turnus was to encourage her to adore him without offending my father, and to seek my father's conversation and approval without letting her feel neglected. Turnus was a fierce, impetuous man, used to getting his way, not used to watching his tongue. He kept up his cautious courtesies pretty well, but sometimes I knew he was as desperate to get the banquet over as I was. It gave me a fellow feeling with him. As a cousin, I liked Turnus. The animal from Africa had bitten my mother painfully and then disappeared. Later on, it was found that one of the hounds had got it eaten its entrails, and left the rest lying by the house wall, where a pregnant weaving woman saw it, thought it was the corpse of a baby, went shrieking into labor, and bore a dead child. That was a creature of ill omen, if ever I saw one.